What is up, you wise and upright judges? Welcome to No Holds Barred, the Shakespeare podcast Shakespeare would have listened to. I'm Dan Bollier.
And I'm Kevin Condardo. We are back for this month's episode of So You're Going to See Shakespeare. The idea of these monthly episodes is it's something you'll listen to in transit to a Shakespearean production so that we can prepare you to be the best little audience member that you can be.
An audio version of the dramaturgical notes, if you will.
So, hopefully, you'll enjoy this episode as you head out to see The Merchant of Venice.
Here we go.
The first thing we need to cover before we get into this episode is a quick synopsis of the play so that you at least know the story. Daniel, take it away.
Sweet. So we start with Bassanio explaining to his wealthy merchant friend Antonio that he is going to go win the hand of a wealthy heiress named Portia, if only he can come up with the money necessary for him to make the trip to meet her in Belmont. Now, the merchant of Venice, Antonio, is more than ready to lend Bassanio the money, but he doesn't have it on hand at the moment. But because his credit is so good, he doesn't think he'll have any problems borrowing the money from someone else.
Bassanio, finding someone to borrow the money from, goes to meet Shylock, a Jewish moneylender based in Venice, and he brings Antonio along with him to serve as the credit. Shylock hates Antonio's guts because Antonio lends money without taking interest, which really kind of undercuts Shylock's whole thing. Shylock takes a moment to ruminate on how weird it is that Antonio is now asking him for money after literally spitting on him in the street, and then he laughs it off and says, yeah, sure, totally, you can have whatever you need, and you know what? Antonio, I'll even give it to you without interest, joking that, you know what, in the event that you can't pay, I'll just, you know, take a pound of your flesh or something crazy like that. Don't even worry about it.
Meanwhile, in Belmont, Portia thinks that it sucks that her dad decided that she would have her husband chosen based on which suitor can correctly solve the box riddle, but she goes along with it all the same. Both the Prince of Morocco and the Prince of Aragon separately take their shots at the box riddle, and both fail. Portia breathes a sigh of relief.
Jessica, thanks. Shylock's daughter, also isn't thrilled at the situation her father has put her in, both because she is kept away from the exciting goings-on that are happening all around her in Venice, and also because her best friend, the house servant Lancelot Gobbo, has decided to leave Shylock and work for Bassanio instead. Before Gobbo leaves, though, Jessica gives him a letter to give to Lorenzo, who Jessica is planning on eloping with. That night, after receiving the letter, Lorenzo and his friends come to Shylock/Jessica's house and help her escape. But before she escapes and runs away with him, she steals a ton of her dad's money and other precious goods and jewels and stuff.
Solario and Solanio, affectionately known as the Salads, hearing of Jessica's escape, laugh at Shylock's misfortune, but also worry about news that several ships have gone missing at sea, since if they are Antonio's and he is unable to repay the loan, he will be directly in the path of Shylock's search for revenge. Shylock, upon seeing them, insists that he will indeed have his pound of flesh if Antonio can't come up with the money.
Bassanio now has, with that money, has arrived at Belmont and, after spending a wonderful few days getting to know Portia, takes a crack at her father's box riddle, and he solves it, thrilling the both of them, as we are all thrilled when we solve a box riddle. Immediately, Graziano, Bassanio's friend, asks if he can have permission to marry Nerissa, Portia's friend. Everything seems great, until word reaches all of them that Antonio is going to be unable to repay Shylock's bond, and Shylock is going to demand his penalty of a pound of flesh. When Portia offers to pay the debt herself, they all are informed that Shylock won't take the money now, even if it's offered. Bassanio apologizes to his newly betrothed and immediately takes off to go help Antonio.
At Antonio's trial, the Duke of Venice appeals to Shylock's mercy, but Shylock declines. Bassanio offers him twice the amount he has due, but Shylock declines. Now, just before the Duke is about to declare sentence, a lawyer named Bellario is announced as having arrived to defend Antonio. What we know, but the court doesn't, dramatic irony, is that Bellario is Portia in disguise, having come to do her best to save Antonio's life. She cross-examines Shylock, and he convinces her to stick to the letter of the bond, which she relents they must do. A joyful Shylock prepares to take his pound of flesh until Bellario points out that the bond says nothing about blood. So, Shylock can have his pound of flesh, but if he spills one drop of blood, he will be sentenced to death. Oops.
Shylock, getting kind of a feel for the situation, agrees to, you know what, he'll just take twice the amount he has due and call it a day, but the court insists that the ship has sailed on that, and now he has to take his pound of flesh. He says he's all good. Bellario then points out that, according to the letter of Venetian law, since he was trying to kill a citizen, his goods are to be turned over to the state, and he can be tried for attempted murder. Double oops. Antonio offers to drop the case and spare Shylock's life, so long as Shylock swears to leave all of his money to Jessica and Lorenzo, and, oh yeah, to convert to Christianity.
A giddy Bassanio offers to pay Bellario for his services, but Bellario refuses any payment except for that very nice ring that he's wearing. Now, Bassanio says he can't give that up because it's his wedding ring and he swore to never take it off, and Bellario makes him feel like crap for being stingy. After Bellario leaves, Graziano says, "Dude, what are you doing?" And Bassanio says, "Oh, man, okay, fine," and sends the ring along as payment.
Once everyone has made it back to Belmont, Bassanio goes to tell Portia all about the crazy case, when Portia notices that Bassanio has lost his ring, or at least isn't wearing it. She makes him feel like crap about it for a bit, until she finally tells them the whole story and everybody's like, whoa. She also tells Antonio that, by the way, all his ships have finally come in because of course they have. Everyone goes inside and has a drink and laughs about, wow, how great everything turned out for everyone in this traditional comedy. And that's The Merchant of Venice. Now that you know basically what you'll be watching, we're going to take a few minutes here to talk about where The Merchant of Venice falls in Shakespeare's personal timeline and what was happening in the world when it was written, Daniel.
Yes. So there's some debate about the year when this was written, but I think for our purposes, we're going to go with 1596, which is in the early end. It's 1596 to 1599 was what I was reading, but I'm prepared to talk about 1596.
Perfect.
So let's go with that. We know that around this time, in terms of Shakespeare's timeline, in 1595, he's coming off, he wrote Richard II, A Midsummer Night's Dream, and Romeo and Juliet. So, heck of a year for Shakespeare. So then he gets asked to write Merry Wives of Windsor, Merchant of Venice, and Henry IV, Part One, probably all around this era. Mm-hmm. So, in terms of what that means for Shakespeare, to me, that just looks like someone who, it's almost like that feeling of, now that I have your attention, now that I've done Richard II, Midsummer, and R&J, and just crushed it, here are some other things I can do. Mm-hmm. And Merry Wives, like, he's forced to write, and this one feels like something, this just feels to me like something that was a personal project that he needed to have permission to write before he could do it. That's purely speculative.
Yeah, and then, so at the time, in the grander scheme of England, usury, which is obviously at the center of this play, was hotly in the church's crosshairs in the 1590s as, quote, a venal sin capable of undermining the very fabric of the social order, end quote. So Antonio's giving of money without interest would have been something very hot on the minds of the Christians hearing this play. There was a book written in 1594 called The Death of Usury, or The Disgrace of Usurers, where Henry Smith regarded usury as, quote, the undoing of men, end quote, and a manifestation of the biblical sin of covetousness. So that kind of gives you a little background about Antonio's situation.
That's really interesting. Thinking about being a merchant or a businessman, and there are two pieces of transaction that are really interesting around this time. In 1596, James Burbage, who is the father of Richard Burbage, who will later be a key member in Shakespeare's life, James Burbage purchases Blackfriars Theatre for the cost of £600. Now, members of the affluent community in which the theatre was located, however, created a petition which was signed by Lord Hunsdon, who was a patron of Burbage's company, and also Richard Field, who was the printer at Blackfriars and Shakespeare's neighbor growing up in Stratford, which forbade playing at the theater at all.
Oh.
So Burbage buys the theater. This is the theater that over a decade later, Shakespeare's company, at the who will then be the Lord's Men, will break down and transport across the Thames, and it will become the Globe.
Interesting. In terms of what Shakespeare's contemporaries were up to or other literary things going on, a few years earlier, Marlowe had written a play called The Jew of Malta, featuring a Jewish character named Barabbas, who's kind of like Shylock if you just made him a two-dimensional cartoon. So you can look at Shylock as being Shylock's roundedness, his motivation as a character, probably could be seen as a counter to Marlowe basically doing like a pretty offensive version of Jewishness, a caricature kind of in that way.
Right.
Another important thing that had come out that would have put this idea of a flesh bond in the minds of Elizabethans was a play, Lazarus Piot's translation of Alexander Sylvain's The Orator had just come out, which features a Jew in that play who has a pound of flesh coming his way as well. And it includes the line, quote, what a matter were it then if I should cut off his privy members, supposing the same would altogether weigh just a pound? So that guy takes taking the pound of flesh nearest to his heart a little less literally.
Right. We're
talking about what he is going to slice.
Extract. Mm. The second transaction or business thing that I was hinting at earlier, in 1597, just after this, Shakespeare purchases New Place, which is the second largest home in Stratford and where it was we now know is Shakespeare's home, which is an extravagant purchase. And just it lets you know that Shakespeare himself is thinking about successful versus dangerous business ventures in terms of like, I'm going to go ahead and buy this monster house back in the country. Hmm. So it's an interesting thought of Shakespeare as a merchant or businessman.
Hmm. And the last interesting thing I found was, you know, we know Shakespeare wasn't writing any of these plays himself. He was stealing it from other plays. The plot of this play, not someone else wrote it, but someone else gave him the plot and he made it awesome. But plot of this play is taken almost wholesale from an Italian play written earlier in the 1500s by Sir Giovanni Fiorento called Il Pecorone, which is Italian for the simpleton. The biggest difference, I mean, it's the whole, you know, guy goes to win this girl, she has a test that you need to pass, blah, blah, blah. The biggest difference is that in that play, the beautiful and capricious Lady of Belmont in Il Pecorone tests her suitors not by choosing of caskets, but by persuading them to wager their wealth against their ability to give her sexual satisfaction.
Oh.
So,
sounds like a good play.
A little bit higher stakes and a little bit it sounds like the Cinemax version of Merchant of Venice, actually.
Skinemax. Actually, wonderful. I always thought Il Pecorino was based on cheese.
Get out of town. That's what was going on in Shakespeare's timeline. Good Lord. This is where we identify what we consider to be the most prominent theme in this play, and particular places where you may see it come up. Dan has chosen his three favorites, and I'm going to pick mine out. My favorite of those choices for us to dig in on here. Daniel.
Yes.
What are our finalists?
So the finalists for Miss Best Theme in The Merchant of Venice are Being the Other, Choice, and Mercy. Being the Other, Choice, and Mercy.
Let's do Choice.
That sounds like a great choice.
Nailed it.
Well done.
What I was prepared to talk about were parents, so I can't really apply that here. Parents and children.
Parents?
Parents and children, yeah. So I guess how I can segue that is, you know, I think it's... choice. So we have... choice echoes, waterfalls down here that, you know, Portia doesn't have her choice of suitor.
Right.
Because her father has set this game where the suitors have to choose between the caskets to win her, but she does choose to accept that even after he's dead, when it would have been very easy after she's inherited the house to be like, no, I'm not going to do that.
Right.
And
chooses to play by the rules.
Exactly.
Inside
even,
of.
Right. You know, even the way that she cheats to help Bassanio is still close enough to within the rules.
Right.
You know, that, like, she doesn't just say, like, pick the crappy one.
Right.
You know, he still has to get the right thing. And, you know, I think you compare that to Jessica's choice to leave Shylock, that Shylock has a bunch of rules, too. Shylock's still alive, and Jessica's like, pass, I'm good.
Right.
You know, I think that's an interesting counterpoint.
Right. The first moment that we meet Shylock, he is in the middle of deciding whether or not he's going to take this bond,
mm-hmm.
Which is a choice for him.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, you know, I think I might do this. And Bassani's like, be assured that you might. He's like, oh, no, trust me. Oh, I will be assured. However, I think I might do this. So mm-hmm. all the different moments, even that sets up. I think it's really interesting that the first moment of seeing this character is in the middle of making a choice.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see him presented with the option.
Mm-hmm.
We just see him deciding,
mm-hmm.
Which is interesting. And talking about, I mean, I think probably one of the most obvious moments of choice is that the three suitors have to choose a casket.
Right.
It's not just that that Portia chooses to go along with this game. The game itself is based around the idea of choice.
Yeah. Tying back to what you were saying about Shylock choosing, you know, we see him in his first moment choosing, but then also in that court scene, he has a series of choices. He can have his bond back. He chooses not to take it. He could have double, right. triple, nine times, triple times triple his bond back. He
right.
chooses not to. Then when he has the law thrown in his face, he chooses to go back to that. It's like, nope. And then the choice that is finally accepted after this whole string of negotiations is, how about I take the state takes half your money, you agree to give the other half of your money to your estranged daughter, and you give up everything you stand for. Is that good? And he has that line, I am content. That's Shylock's last choice.
Right. Right.
You know, tracking his choices throughout is, it's an interesting thing that I never really thought about, but you can follow that.
Right. It's funny, sort of the counter argument to choice, or a character who I think sometimes feels like at the whims of others, is Bassanio, who, you notice it in the scene with when Lancelot comes in and he's like, do you want something from me? And Lancelot's like, I want to serve you. And he's like, okay, then. And then Lancelot leaves and Graziano comes in and he's like, I have a suit to you. And he's like, what is it? He's like, I need to go to Belmont. And he's like, well, then yes, you do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I must with you to Belmont, and Bassanio's answer is, well, then you must.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I guess so. Like, he is a character in this world of people who are making tons of choices, who is just doing that whole, like, I am powerless in this world.
Mm-hmm.
I have nothing, like, I can't really do anything. I can't do anything.
Tossed like ships upon the ocean.
Right?
Yeah.
So you do have characters who make strong choices versus those who feel like they are at the whims of others.
Yeah. So there you go. Choice. Keep your eye out for it when you go out to see The Merchant of Venice. In this section of the show, we choose which non-title characters we would most want to play in this piece and explain why in 2 minutes or less. I won the coin flip before the show, and I had a witness, and I've elected to go first. So here we go. As we've already established, The Merchant of Venice is Antonio, so with him off the board... I'm going to take Shylock. I think Shylock is an amazing character. As a lover of antagonists, no one will be surprised that I would like to take Shylock. But, I mean, I think, you know, I've said this before, that I, as a contract man myself in real life, I think this is a play about contract law. And I think there's a lot that we can learn from here in this. But, you know, and that is to learn is to make sure your fine print is tidied up, because it should have been something in there like a pound of flesh and all related detritus. You just need a caveat in there. Anyways, I relate with Shylock. I think that there's a lot to be mined here. I think he has a rage that is justifiable in a way that is so much fun, but like there's so much to chew on in it, you know, whereas, you know, you look at like Richard, or you look at Edmund, or you look at King John, or all those guys have a rage, but it's their, they are put in a position of, they are making the choice to go down this road to better themselves, to improve their position. Shylock is cornered. You know, he is just firing back out. And so everything that he's coming back with, what's his line where he says, it's not the ills you teach me.
It shall go hard, but I shall better the instruction.
Yes,
the
I shall
the
better
line,
the instruction.
What's the beginning of that line?
But that's the gist of it, that he's like, look, I was doing fine until you guys started treating me like crap, and now I'm coming back. You're going to get the horns. And so, yeah, I think Shylock would be a lot of fun. So Shylock.
Yeah, good choice. Solid choice. And a tricky answer on this question, since so many people who don't listen to this podcast think that The Merchant of Venice is a reference to Shylock. Mm. So you kind of snuck one in there.
I'll take it.
But now that I can't play Antonio or Shylock with my third pick, I suppose, there's a lot of great roles in here. This is a really tricky one. So I think that for the sake of this argument, I'll go with sort of the most wheelhousey role for me.
Mm-hmm.
Of all of these great parts, because I'm feeling tonight like I don't really feel like working that hard.
I can
Whereas
tell.
Some nights I would just go, hey, you know what? Bassanio would be really hard. It's a good stretch.
Mm-hmm.
He's so likable and has so conflict. Like, what a great actor's challenge. But you know what? In a show like this, there's going to be heavy conversations. I'll just play the guy that's most like me, Graziano.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
about
right.
I know. He comes in the first scene and is like, why is everyone sad? And Antonio's like, all the world's a stage and we're all players. And he's like, cool, I'll be the clown. Can I play the clown? I like the idea of playing the clown.
Mm-hmm.
And then shows up and he's like, hey, Bassanio, I heard you're going to Belmont. I'm going to come with you. And Bassanio's like, yeah, you can, but just hold it together for like 3 hours. Which is kind of
cool.
Like how I feel when I'm like, hey, Kev, I'm going to go to that event with you. And you're like, yeah, you can come, but just like wear a nice shirt and don't say anything stupid. And I'm like, I'll do my best.
No promises.
I can promise you at least through the third drink at the open bar. But after that, just get me home. Throw me in an Uber and get me out of there. But he also does have the great discovery of Nerissa.
Mm-hmm.
And Bassanio kind of hints at it. Like, is this for real? Is this like a real thing? And he's like, no, I really, honestly, like, she's the real deal.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot to play with. I feel like it's one of those roles. It's like low risk, high reward.
Mm-hmm.
Like you really can steal the show,
mm-hmm.
but also if you just say the lines, like it's a well written enough part that you're not going to upset anybody.
Right.
By you're gonna get laughs. Go in, punch your time card, and go home. Mm-hmm.
Get in the crease, dig in.
Drink a couple beers.
So there you go. Those are our favorite roles from The Merchant of Venice. This is the section of the show where we pull our favorite phrase from this play and talk through it so that you can nod smugly and knowingly when you hear it in production.
Mm-hmm.
The line we chose from The Merchant of Venice is, what, wouldst thou have a serpent sting thee twice? From Act 4, Scene 1. Let's hear the phrase in context. You'll ask me why I rather choose to have a weight of carrion flesh than to receive 3,000 ducats. I'll not answer that. But say, is it my humor? Is it answered? What if my house be troubled with a rat and I be pleased to give 10,000 ducats to have it banned? What, are you not answered yet? Some men there are love not a gaping pig, some that are mad if they behold a cat, and others, when the bagpipe sings in the nose, cannot contain their urine. For affection, mistress of passion, sways it to the mood of what it likes or loathes. Now for your answer, as there is no firm reason to be rendered why he cannot abide a gaping pig, why he a harmless necessary cat, why he a woolen bagpipe, but of force must yield to such inevitable shame as to offend himself being offended, so can I give no reason, nor I will not, more than a lodged hate and a certain loathing I bear Antonio, that I follow thus a losing suit against him. Are you answered?
This is no answer, thou unfeeling man, to excuse the current of thy cruelty.
I am not bound to please thee with my answers.
Do all men kill the things they do not love?
Hates any man the thing he would not kill?
Every offense is not a hate at first.
What? Wouldst thou have a serpent sting thee twice? That was What Wouldst Thou Have a Serpent Sting Thee Twice from Act 4, Scene 1. Dan, can you give us some context for this bit?
Yeah, of course. This is, we are right at the beginning of the trial scene. And basically, Shylock is there and they're all like, "What? Here's double the money. Here's all the money. Here's anything you need. Why are you doing this?" And he's like, "I'm not going to answer that question. Mm-hmm. I'm doing it because I'm doing it." And then goes on this list of examples about, like, you know what? I might have a mouse problem in my house, and I'm going to pay $1 million to have 4 mice killed. You know why? Because I can.
Because it bothers me.
Because it bothers... Right. And then Bassanio comes in and says, you know, he's... The question that he keeps coming back to, are you answered? Are you answered? Are you answered? Mm-hmm. Bassanio picks that up and says, "This is, you're not answering anything. This is not an answer to excuse the current of thy cruelty. You're being outrageous right now. Mm-hmm. This is not a pleasing answer." And Shylock says, "I don't need to please you. Mm-hmm. Go pound sand.
Mm-hmm. I don't owe you anything.
Right.
You owe me a pound of flesh.
You owe me a pound of flesh." And Bassanio's like, "Listen, so we owe you a pound of flesh. Does that mean you have to kill someone?" And Shylock says, "I mean, if you hate it, well, shouldn't you kill it?" Mm-hmm. And Bassanio is saying, "Well, you know, it's not like it has to be a hate right away. It doesn't all have to be hate. The first time someone wrongs you, you don't have to hate them for it." And Shylock comes back with the image of, you know, like, if a poisonous snake bites you once, isn't that enough?
Right. You're not going to be like, "You know what? I feel like the snake has some things to really offer the community. Maybe we should stick around with this snake."
Right.
Yeah, and I think also, like, there's just, that's such a loaded line too, because Shylock mentions earlier when he meets with Antonio the first time we see him that everybody, like, spits on him in public. Like, everybody just craps all over him. And then they come to him for money. And now here they're like, "Well, why are you doing this?" He's like, "You've been kicking me in the street for years. Like, why wouldn't I?"
Right.
You know, he's backed into a corner. This is his only chance to redress not only what's happened to him, but what's happened to his whole people. So, yeah, he's like,
"Right,
you only get one shot. Do not miss your chance to go. This opportunity comes once in a lifetime, yo."
Yo, which is oi backwards.
Jesus.
That's true. That checks out.
It does. You're not wrong.
Think is really interesting in here is in this scene in particular, especially in the beginning of the scene, there are a number of longer passages, including the one that we started this clip with. But that's not the only one there. It's just like monologue city. Mm-hmm. And then there's this moment here, these 6 lines of it's Tecumithia. It's straight up. Boom, 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 boom. One line, one question, one statement. Real. And it'd be interesting, I think, to think about how it's played when you're going to see the show. Look out for this. Just think about, you know, do they go at this like machine gun, like, bah, 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 bah? Mm-hmm. Or is it more like letting each of these statements really land? Because it's almost like in boxing. Mm-hmm. It, like, this exchange is, after a bunch of, like, dancing around and a little bit of jabbing, mm-hmm. it's just, like, 6
right.
hooks.
Set your feet, and they just go to town.
And they all land. I mean, they all land.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think is, it's a really interesting, all men kill the things they do not love, hates any man the thing that he would not kill. Both sides here, I mean, this is what makes a good argument. Mm-hmm. They're both stating their cases, and they're both, you can see the validity of both sides.
Mm-hmm. And comparing Bassanio looking for subjective measures and Shylock sticking completely objectively, like not allowing for an appeal to reason, not allowing for an appeal to emotion, sticking to reason. Yeah. So there you go. Keep an eye out for that line when you see the show. Here we will highlight the biggest practical challenge to the director in this play and share a few ideas on how it has been solved in the past. For The Merchant of Venice, we think the biggest challenge is the line, "His Jewish heart," in Act 4, Scene 1. Let's turn it over to Dan to give us that monologue in context.
"I pray you, think. You question with the Jew. You may as well go stand upon the beach and bid the main flood bait his usual height. You may as well use question with the wolf, why he hath made the ewe bleat for the lamb. You may as well forbid the mountain pines to wag their high tops and to make no noise when they are fretting with the gust of heaven. You may as well do anything most hard as seek to soften that. Then which, what's harder? His Jewish heart. Therefore I do beseech you, make no more offers, use no farther means, but with all brief and plain conveniency, let me have judgment, and the Jew his will.
Thank you, Daniel. So, for a little context on what's going on here, this is right after the scene that we had just talked about, where everybody's trying to reason with Shylock's emotion, and Antonio's like, you know what, you guys are wasting your time. Everyone knows a Jew will never change his mind on matters of business. It's tough.
It's very tough.
This is
something bigger than just, like, how do you solve a harpy coming up through the middle of right. A trapdoor.
Or Diana appearing in the moon.
Right. This is a question. And this is a question which is a question Shakespeare would not have had to answer in the same way, because it's impossible to look at this play in the wake of World War II and the Holocaust as anything other than anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm.
It raises the question of how is this or how is this not an anti-Semitic play? And it's a question that if you're directing the play, you have to think long and deep about.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you just come up and say, you know what? No, Shakespeare wrote it as a comedy, so we're doing it as a comedy.
And
you better be prepared for some serious letters.
Right, when you get to specifically this line. Because like Dan was saying before we started, Antonio is this like kindly father figure. He's willing to sacrifice everything for Bassanio. He's so giving. His Jewish heart, and you're like,
right.
So it's something that you definitely need to figure out a way, and you know, it expands beyond just this line. It's the
right.
It's the anti-Semitism that's rampant throughout the rest of the play, but it's not something you can gloss over. You can't cut this line.
Right.
You know, it has to be in there, so the director needs to figure out about how they're going to deal with this.
Yeah. It's something I've never seen a production of The Merchant of Venice live. I've seen movies, and I was in a reading and was in this scene as Bassanio. So I did not, something that the actor playing Shylock brought up is that Bassanio is one of the only characters that actually doesn't use, doesn't call Shylock the Jew or a Jew. And that was something that Antonio and I were playing with, was that's Antonio being like, hey, Bassanio, stop calling him an unfeeling man. Stop calling him all these other, there's a lot of times Bassanio has these thou blanks.
Yeah.
And he always comes up with something else.
Uh-huh.
This was the moment of Antonio being like, make it about Bassanio, stop lying to yourself. Let's see the world for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Which was very hard.
Yeah.
Very hard to be a part of.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know. I've seen a couple productions, and every time this line comes out, there's a gasp of discomfort at best.
All right.
From the audience. I don't know what the solution is. I mean, I think the best chance you have, the only way I can see it even having a chance is to give Shylock as much justification and make him as realized as possible as you can. So, like, Shylock can be justified and also a crappy dude.
Sure.
You know, it's coming out of his motivation. There is plenty of motivation for Shylock to kind of fly off the handle and demand this thing. But if he's just like a snidely whiplash, two-dimensional propaganda caricature,
yeah.
It's a real ugly scene.
Right.
So I think that's the pathway to making this work.
The other thing, I think the other pathway is to lean into it and to say, you know what, this is offensive and I hope it offends you and I hope we can talk about it.
Mm.
And to say, yes, I am available to talk to anyone and everyone after the show. I would love to talk to you about it. Why did it upset you? And just go for it and not try to gloss over it or hide it, because that may be in fact more offensive than just saying, you know what, this play is it wasn't written that way, but the world has changed, and now this play is anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
And let's just talk about that, and maybe we can come to something better.
Yeah. So there you go. When you go to see this play, let us know how they deal with this line and the play as a whole, his Jewish heart. And that's going to do it for us for this episode. If you found this helpful, please subscribe, rate, and review us in iTunes so we can keep bringing Shakespeare to your headphones on a weekly basis. If you have questions or comments you'd like to send our way, you can email us at noholdsbarredpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet us at noholdsbarredcast, or you can Facebook us at facebook.com. No Holds Barred Cast. So, until next time, I'm Kevin Condardo.
And I'm Dan Bollier.
Well, while I live, I'll fear no other thing.
So sore as keeping safe Nerissa's ring.